well met, friends. I'm Steph Midlock.
And I'm Jude Vase.
Welcome to Athrobeth, a podcast exploring the elven invocations of Tolkien's Legendarium. Do we have any corrections coals to sack this week, Jude? This month, Jude?
No, I don't believe we do. I'm sure we talked quite a bit last episode, and I'm sure that I put my foot in my mouth at least once, as I'm wont to do. But nobody called me out on it, so I'm going to pretend that it didn't happen.
Yeah, remember, guys, you have to call us on our bullshit if you hear it. Otherwise, we're just going to keep marching on like nothing happened. It's fine.
That's right.
Well, we did want to give kind of a shout out to a recent event that took place in the Tolkien world.
Yeah, we sat brewing in our own jealousy and FOMO here in America while many of you cool Tolkien kids were off in Birmingham. Yeah. At Tolkien 2019. We wish we were there. And you all looked like you had a blast. So that was super cool. We're already trying to figure out what conventions and events and conferences we can do in the future. Because that really made us realize how badly we want to get more directly involved in the wider Tolkien community, so that we do not miss the next big event like that. I don't know if they're going to do Tolkien 2020, but if they do, that's high on our list of things to maybe try and do. The UK is kind of a long haul for us, but I think we're going to see if that's something we can do, or maybe 2021 or something like that.
It's not too far as the Nazgul flies.
You know. I can't hear, this is a random aside that probably won't make the final edit, but I can't hear that phrase without thinking of the blog that you made when you were living in China.
That's a really good piece of trivia. Yeah, when I lived in China, I had a cool blog. Well, it was not a cool blog. It was an uncool blog with my friend Nissa, who's a big Tolkien fan too. And we did a whole, like, Lord of the Rings, like, I don't know what it was, like a mock entry about our trip to Xi'an, which was, like, fraught with things.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there were lots of, like, really not that clever references in there. And I wish I still had it. I don't have it anymore. It's gone.
But you said you made some very, very funny reference about As the Nazgul Flies. And I remember sitting at work at Pure Digital fucking dying, like... suffocating myself at my desk to stop from like drawing undue attention to myself, laughing at what you guys had written.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish. Yeah, dude, I wish I still had that blog. That was amazing. I it was like an old Blogspot blog. So it's probably for the best that it's gone, but it was pretty good. Nice.
Yeah.
Somebody, if anyone finds it, let me know. That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
I'd die forever.
Cool. Anyway. So, yeah, that was really cool to watch from a distance over Twitter. Thanks, everybody that was on Twitter and keeping all of us people that couldn't attend feeling connected and jealous.
Yeah. And man, it was. Yeah, we like made lots of new Twitter friends just over the weekend from all of you wonderful people. So hi, new friends, new listeners. Maybe, huh? Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
We're so glad you're here. Thank you. And you're all very nice and cool. And maybe someday we shall meet you on the Emerald Isle. Who knows?
Yeah. Wait, I think that's...
Is that Ireland?
Ireland. I think that's
Jesus.
Ireland, not the UK.
Christ.
You're from Jesus. The UK.
I don't know. That was loud. I just blew out speakers. I am partially... All right. You know
well,
what?
Well, the Isle of Man's not really Britain either, so...
What is it? What did Tolkien write then? Oh, the Lonely Isle.
Something like that.
Island?
Yeah.
What? Gosh darn it. Okay, whatever. It's fine.
We're all good. It's all fine.
We have a podcast about this. It's fine.
Next week's corrections calls to sack is all about the nicknames for the British Isles that we blundered in this intro.
I'm so sorry, everybody from there. Sorry.
All right.
So what are we doing in this crazy cool episode then?
This episode, we're going to be talking about... This is a fun episode, actually. This episode, we're going to be doing a little bit of a flashback. Before we ever recorded our first episode, the very first Tolkien thing Steph and I talked about as a kind of trial run was a weird piece from Vinyar Tengwar 43 called Words of Joy, Five Catholic Prayers in Quenya. This was sort of the piece that I dragged out to talk about to sort of test our chemistry and to see how this whole format would work. And man, it's remarkable that you guys have a podcast to listen to because it really didn't go well.
Oh, it went bad.
It went bad.
It was bad.
Yeah, I did not put together much of an outline.
And I didn't know anything about anything. And I still don't, but I mask it better now after a year of practice.
It was rough, but we decided to do it again. And I think I put a lot more work into that first outline, and that made a difference. And we got better at it. But yeah, that first recording, it was hot garbage. So it should be noted, I put a lot more effort into this outline, and we've got a lot more experience. And I'm looking forward to this recording quite a bit more than I would be to playing you that one.
But guess what? I still, after having a year to have read this, I still have not read this. So, you know, shocking nobody. I am underprepared for this, and I'm sorry.
I remember thinking at the time, like, well, Steph went to Catholic school, so she'll at least be able to, like, speak to the Catholic parts of all this.
I didn't go to Catholic school. I was did the first communion, and I was confirmed as a Catholic, which is not the same because you don't have to do that much effort to be confirmed as a Catholic. They're Great.
I remember you correcting my misconception there and then realizing that that meant you were going to be no fucking help on the Catholic concepts in this.
I have no idea about anything. I'm so sorry. You know what, though? I'll just pretend I know what I'm talking about, just like always. So it'll be no different than any other episode.
Well, that sounds good.
Great. Well, we've got many holy paths to tread. So let's begin.
What is this piece? What are we looking at today? It is called Words of Joy, Five Catholic Prayers in Quenya. It comes in two parts. It was published in Vinyar Tangwar 43 and 44.
May I ask a question?
Certainly.
You've told me before, but tell me again. What is Vinyar Tangwar for those who may not know?
Vinyar Tangwar is a linguistic journal published by the ELF, which is a little on the nose, if you ask me, the Elvish Linguistic Fellowship, an organization that was founded in 1988 to research Tolkien's languages. We're going to talk a lot more about these various linguistic journals and all things Tolk language in a couple of months when we take on the history of Tolkien's language invention. But for now, Vinyar Tangwar is a journal that sort of focuses on his invented languages and their grammars and things like that. And these two pieces, this one piece split across two issues, was edited by three of the journal's principal editors and writers and luminaries, Patrick Wynn, Arden R. Smith, and Carl F. Hostetter.
Nice. Good job,
Hostetter,
guys.
Is the director of the Elvish Linguistic Fellowship and is kind of one of the most central names in that organization.
Carl, good job. That's
also,
awesome.
Fun fact about Carl F. Hostetter, he wrote one of my favorite pieces in Elven Quenya literature, which we'll talk about a little bit later, called Elvish as She Is Spoke, which is basically a diss track. Yeah, no kidding.
Really? Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to keep going there.
It's a diss track against people who do Neo-Quenya, against one specific person who does Neo-Quenya.
There's a little rivalry going here, I see.
Not a little one. Like, he has a long-standing beef with people that do Neo-Quenya, as opposed to, like, academic deconstruction and, like, the very specific kind of academic Quenya that is done that he thinks is the proper way. Right. Which isn't cool. to say that he's, you know, a jerk about it. I took a class that he spoke at, and he was very cool, but he has a very specific belief about the, based on the limitations of the language, the way to approach it. So, we'll talk more about that in a couple months. But anyway,
how am I gonna learn how to say dank meme in Quenya if we don't have Neo Quenya? That's all I'm gonna say. Okay, we'll talk about this
That's
later.
An excellent question.
Could you please figure out how to say dank meme? And also, can someone tell me what a dank meme is? Because I don't know what that is. I'm old.
I literally just wrote a note about that so I can tweet about it. Okay. So what this piece consists of is five Catholic prayers, the Pater Noster, the Ave Maria, the Gloria Patri, the Subtuum Presidium, and the Litany of Loreto, all of them translated into Quenya by Tolkien.
Wow. Tolkien was a Catholic.
Yes, in case you hadn't picked up on that in the course of, being exposed to him or this podcast or, you know, whatever. Yes, Tolkien was an extremely devout Catholic. And it mentions in the essays in Vinyar Tangwar, it references several letters that he wrote to his son over the course of his life that he took great comfort personally in these prayers and litanies and things like that, in his faith and in his personal life. He found that repeating them and using them was very comforting.
Aww.
So, which I think is really interesting, and I think is noteworthy as to why he would choose to translate these.
It definitely makes sense. I mean, we know that Tolkien's family, you know, was religious, and Tolkien's mother became a Catholic later in life, and it mm-hmm. was actually a Catholic priest that took care of Tolkien and his brother when their mother passed away. So obviously the church was a very important part of their lives. So it makes sense that he would find some comfort in this.
Yeah. Yeah. So aside from the sort of personal biographical stuff, and from the linguistic value that these provide, one of my favorite things about these are a really nice little snapshot into Tolkien's weird process.
Ooh, cool. How so?
So they're written on various kinds of blank sheets of paper, and also he has personal postcards from Merton College, and several of these are written on the fronts and backs of these personalized postcards. I think it's pretty baller that he got personalized postcards for being a professor.
like your good correspondence stock, like from the desk of J.R.R. Tolkien.
No, exactly that. Exactly that.
Man, cool. Why is that not a thing anymore?
Right?
I want all my tweets to say from the desk of Steph Midlock, right? Oh, boy.
There's pictures in Vinyar Tangwar 43 and 44 of some of these postcards, and we'll put them up on the Instagram when the episode goes live, because they're very cool. You can see his baller weird handwriting, and also how he just like he doesn't even like work in the margins. He's just like straight across everything. But he's also filling up the margins with little notes, and it's very interesting.
Cool.
It's very fun to see. But yeah, he writes in, it's a really great example of how he does this, like just grabs a piece of paper and just dumps information onto it. He uses whatever's around, any kind of pen he's got around, writes at various speeds. Sometimes it's a ballpoint, sometimes it's a fountain pen. Sometimes he's writing carefully, sometimes he's scribbling fast. He covers it in corrections of linguistics. He writes notes about specific grammar in the columns. Then sometimes he takes very careful, he'll go and do a new version very, very carefully on a new sheet. Of the five prayers, so there's five prayers. Two of them, the first two, the Pater Noster and the Ave Maria, exist in multiple versions. Specifically, the Pater Noster is in six revisions, and wow. The Ave Maria is in four revisions. And those are the most interesting to me, because you see the evolution of his thought as he's revising them over time. So those are going to be the ones we talk about the most.
Wow.
But the other three are also really interesting, because you can see where he wrote them, you can see him using the conceptions as he's evolved, how he translates. You can see how his translation methodology has changed as he's translating those last three prayers.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, like assuming he went in order or whatever. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Huh, neat.
The last thing I really like about this article is the authors do a super interesting job of tracking down the dating of the pieces.
Cool.
This is a thing that Christopher Tolkien does. He's like a professional, like detective, like dad's writing detective. And they do a really good job of it as well. And you get a good snapshot of the various ways that people use to try and date Tolkien's stuff. So they do things like, the dates on other, so these, none of them are dated, but some of the other stuff that they're filed next to is dated. So they're like, all right, well, these papers are dated in 1948 and the ones over here are dated in 1956. So somewhere in between 48 and 56, other stuff is way more specific. Like they know that in a certain year he stopped using the MMA suffix as the exclusive we in Quenya and started using it as the inclusive our. In a very specific year, they know he started doing that. And in these examples, we see that change happen. So we knew that at some point that, you know, in that year, he was editing these prayers because we see that grammatic change take place in these edits.
Wow, that's amazing. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah. We also see the consistent use of C instead of K, which is a convention he established in Lord of the Rings. So we know that they were written after the Lord of the Rings. And we also know that he didn't use ballpoint pens until later in life. So we know that they're after a certain point in his life, he started using ballpoint pens more. And so we know that.
Oh, they really are like detectives. That's cool.
Yeah, no. And this is like not the full list. There were like 9 or 10 things that they used to date these items. I only picked out like 4 of the more interesting ones.
That's cool. Yeah, we've talked about his like desk stratigraphy before and how that's got to be, you know, so important.
I'm sorry. You want to back up and use that word again for me? I didn't.
Desk stratigraphy?
Yeah, you're the archaeologist.
Oh, stratigraphy is like the layers in which like soil and sort of rock layers have been laid down over the years. And so if it's an undisturbed stratigraphy, you can kind of map the different soil changes and get like an idea of how many, you know, roughly how many thousands of years old something might be.
That seems like an accurate metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that actually
seems
really accurate.
It's like going through the crap in my car, right? It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, the way that they look through like his boxes of papers or his filing, that seems like a really accurate metaphor.
Yeah.
So anyway, the short version is they use all of this stuff to establish that the prayers were written as close as they can get is at various times throughout the 50s.
Okay.
Is about when they think these were written.
And where does this kind of fall in? And we'll talk about this more in the coming episodes when we focus on his language creation. But where does this fall kind of roughly in his timeline of language creation? Was he already sort of into it? Was it still developing at this time? Like
this
in the 50s?
At a very mature phase in the language creation. So
okay.
He had Quenya was fully developed. Sindarin was fully developed. This was after the Lord of the Rings, after he had started writing Lord of the Rings. So that spelling convention had been established. So what that means is that he was still tweaking things a little bit. There were still changes being made to the languages. That never stopped. But the languages themselves were extremely mature. He'd been working on them at this point for 30 plus years.
Wow.
So they were very well developed.
Yeah.
As we'll see, these poems reference stuff in the older forms of the languages, but they are definitely written in a reasonably mature form of Quenya, like a, I would say, like a sort of Lord of the Ringsy kind of Quenya.
Cool. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of helps to just know the context. Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah. So That alone, to me, would make these interesting. Like, that enough is enough to make these interesting. But as it turns out, there's an extra layer of why these are interesting. That make these things extra interesting for me. They make these extra my bullshit.
Extra on brand.
Extra on brand. Cool. Yeah.
Super brand.
Super brand. Yeah.
Ooh.
Tolkien was very conservative about the ways that he let his Catholicism intersect with his mythology. You very rarely see religiosity in general in Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. And you definitely do not see overt Catholicism or Christianity in Middle Earth. There are very, very few references to anything that could be perceived as Christian in Middle Earth.
Right.
I mean, the...
No, I... You're
the
right.
The concept... Sorry, go ahead.
No, oh no, I'm sorry to interrupt you. No, I was just going to say, you know, as a casual Tolkien fan, I didn't really ever pick up on the Catholic thing until we did that terrible recording, a year ago, and you told me. So, mm-hmm. Absolutely. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, other than, like, there's a concept of a fall, and there's a concept of, if you look, like, in the Tale of Adonel, if you remember from Atherbeth, there's the concept of, like, man having committed an original sin. There's bits and pieces here and there, but, man, he doesn't, like, you know, he doesn't like putting that stuff in overtly.
Right, which is very unlike his pal C.S. Lewis, right? Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that is not only, like, full of the imagery, but also, like, the actual vernacular as well. There's, like, a part where Mr. Tumnus refers to Lucy as, like, a daughter of Eve, which kind of indicates that, like, everyone mm-hmm. from, you know, humans are, like, descended from Adam and Eve, made in his yeah. capital H image. So it's even, like, the language is in there.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
totally
yeah.
unlike Tolkien completely. So it's really neat.
Yeah. Tolkien's stuff, he did let his Catholicism influence his world building. We've talked about before my love of The Flame Imperishable, a book by Jonathan McIntosh that really documents the ways in which Catholic philosophy really sort of influenced the world building and the spirituality and the philosophy that underpins Middle Earth. That book is so good, and I really, really recommend it.
Oh,
but
cool.
It's not overt. But there's a really interesting thing going on in these prayers. The very first version of these prayers are more or less transliterations for all intents and purposes. They are a direct word-for-word translation. And you can see in this early version, he's much more overtly Catholic in these translations. Over time, however, something really interesting happens, wherein he is apparently unsatisfied with that methodology, and he starts translating the concepts rather than the words.
Interesting.
So what happens is you start getting him translating these ideas of, like, heaven from, like, a direct translation of the word heaven into a concept that an elf would have, like, beyond Ea.
Oh, that's so cool.
So it becomes, like, what I would call, like, a semantic translation.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So we're going to dig into that a little bit. The way the journals are laid out, or the way the authors of this piece break it down, is they go word by word through every prayer, and they break down how it is changed over each revision of the poem, and they go into the linguistic value. I'm not going to do that because that would take fucking forever and it would be boring. But I looked at a few of them, and I looked at the ones that seemed kind of interesting
mm-hmm.
For how they changed and for what the sort of that looked like. and for how the for what it sort of represented, for how it showed that semantic shift happening in the translation. So I picked out four examples. We'll take a look at some of these examples. And then we're going to look at kind of a wider, pull back a little bit and take a wider look at how we can see this, where else we see this happening in Tolkien's works, this shift from a more specific religiosity to a more sort of a focus, just sort of where else we see this shift happening in his life and in his work. I will put a caveat on this that I cheated on this episode. A lot of this work I did for a paper in a class for Signum University / Mythgard University.
Ooh, cool.
So if this
Smarty.
Stuff sounds interesting, it's because I took a cool class on Tolkien's language invention that was actually taught in part by Dr. Femi.
Our friend. Oh, that's amazing. She's so cool.
Yeah. If you are not sponsored, hashtag not sponsored, but if you're a fan of Tolkien stuff, you can actually go and take the class that I took. You can buy the lecture pack for that class and watch the same lectures I took. And hear all the same lectures from all these various cool things. You can hear Hostetter talk and Dr. Femi give guest lectures. Her co-author on the expanded edition of A Secret Vice is the principal teacher. Yeah, the Mythgard is great. I don't give them enough props as regularly as I should for the influence they've had on my academic development. So
that's really cool.
That's where much of the research for this episode came from, was a paper I did for a class there. I'm shamelessly reusing it. But yeah, that's where a lot of this came from.
Cool. I think that's fine. That's, I mean, you wrote it,
well,
right?
So yeah,
that's
cool. I wrote it. So I have no shame. But I just thought that was worth calling out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a wonderful resource and available to all, so go for it.
All right. Well, so let's start. Basically, the first one we're going to look at is from what's called the Atarema, which is the Quenya translation for Pater Noster. In the first line, there is a line, "Who art in heaven?"
Oh, that's a real famous one.
Yeah.
I say that one all the time in the, right? In the Our Father or the Lord's Prayer or whatever it's called.
Yep.
Somebody's in heaven, and his name is Art. Just kidding.
Yep, Art's in heaven. So this is a really interesting example. As we said with the Pater Noster, there's six revisions of this.
That's so many revisions. That's so many.
And Tolkien's translations of this word changes really interestingly over time.
Who art in heaven?
Yeah, this who art in heaven. Specifically the heaven part.
Okay.
Yeah. So the earliest version that he uses is a really literal one. He uses the word menel, which has the meaning firmament, high heaven, the region of the stars, which is etymologically accurate. It's actually almost identical to the translation of the English word heaven. But he isn't really satisfied with it. He keeps it for the first five versions of the poem. The first five revisions. But then in the fifth one, he scratches it out and he replaces it with Ea Pel Ea, which is who is beyond Ea.
Okay. And just to remind our listeners who may not know, Ea is the earth, right?
No, Ea is everything.
Everything. Oh, it's everything.
Ea, it's
all being. Encompassing.
Yeah. This is a really interesting phrase because it echoes language in the Aina Lindale and is also interesting because it's kind of echoes more modern conceptions of heaven as opposed to sort of medieval conceptions of heaven being literally like the sky.
Like a plate. Yeah.
Yeah. But for me, though, it really is the part that I really focus on is that it's specifically elven imagery. It is beyond Ea, which is language pretty much directly out of the Aina Lindale. Yeah, please.
Can I ask you a question? And you can cut this if it doesn't really make sense, but...
Yeah, go for it.
Is it in the Aina Lindale that we learned that when Melkor got in big trouble, he got put, like, out beyond Ea?
No, that is in the Silmarillion, at the very end of the Silmarillion.
Okay, so he didn't go to heaven then, though, did he? That's not.
No, he went into the dark. So, yeah, what this is basically beyond, who is beyond heaven?
Is
different than, so what basically this is saying is who is beyond heaven is basically saying back to Ilúvatar.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So like in this context of our father, you know, who is in heaven. So saying who is beyond Ea is making a reference to Ilúvatar because he is outside of Ea. He's the only thing beyond Ea.
Gotcha. Because he made it all.
Yeah.
I'm with you now. He's the creator. Mm-hmm. I'm with you.
Yeah. So I really like this example because it's Tolkien making a choice to change a perfectly good Quenya word. He has this word Menel, which is a perfectly good word for what he's doing for heaven. Mm-hmm. And he's changing it not because the word isn't good enough, but because the concept he wants, because it's not elvish enough, or because the concept that he's trying to convey isn't working for him. And the one he chooses to use is more elvish.
That's really interesting. And that's like the immersion that we get in Tolkien's worlds, right? That's why they're so rich and beautiful.
Mm-hmm,
because you're totally submersed in them. There's nothing that's going to pull you out and be like, wait, what? What? God, daughter of Eve? What's that about?
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
So we're going to jump ahead to a different line, which has a similar one. So if we go down to line 5, there's another usage of the word heaven where he starts out with a similar, with a different version of that same root, Menel, Menele. And then that in the first version of the Etareme, it starts out as Menele, then it becomes Menelze, but then it shifts and it becomes Emenelde, Erumande, and then in the last versions, it's Erumande.
It so actually eventually becomes Milli Vanilli. So
Milli Vanilli, yes, Milli of course. Milli Vanilli,
yeah.
The well-known, yeah.
That's the seventh revision.
Yeah. So this one is super interesting. Erumande is a really interesting word because Eruman is kind of a hard word to translate, but the Vinyar Tengwar glosses it as Eru, as in Ilúvatar,
okay,
plus man, an element of unknown meaning, but which appears in Aman, meaning blessed or free from evil, and Manwe, blessed being, and gives it a meaning of the blessedness of Eru, or the blessed dwelling of Eru.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And furthermore, the term is persistently associated with key locations in the journey of the souls of men after death.
Oh, wait a minute now. All right. It sounds like we're talking to our friend with the harp again, right? Finrod. Finway. Yeah. Finface.
So basically...
his name was.
Going back to that line one that we were just talking about, we start out with this very literal Menele, Menelze. These are basically grammatical shifts as he's changing up the grammar. He's changing that suffix. And then he shifts to Emenelde, which I believe is another grammatic shift. And then in Adorama 5, he then shifts it to Erumande. So he's shifting from in heaven to in the blessed dwelling of Eru, which is even more than Ea, beyond Eru, or beyond Ea. It becomes even more literal that he's doing this semantic translation, because it has now become from in heaven to the blessed dwelling of Eru. he's now calling the name of the god of his world mm-hmm. is now being used explicitly, and he's making reference to a concept that he consistently associates with the journey of men's souls in his own legendarium. Eruman is a concept that he's used multiple times, and he's recycled multiple times in his world building as a place where men's souls rest before they pass on.
Whoa, that's super cool. That's awesome. All right. That's a very interesting shift. I like that you can see in each different version.
Yeah.
How that sort of became, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yep. I have nothing else to say about that. It's cool. It's really neat.
Yeah, this one is... These two are really good because they show, maybe Ea Apella Ea, he's just being a little artistic. But then that's the left jab to set you up for the right hook of Eruman, which is so very explicit in its elvishness. It's hard to make the argument that that's not a Middle Earth reference, that cool. he is not drawing this prayer into Middle Earth. By using this phrase. So we've got some other ones though. Ooh. So now we're going to go back up to line one, but of a different poem. In the Ayar Maria, the Ave Maria,
mm-hmm.
grace is a really interesting word again. So it starts out as erulisinen.
Okay.
And then it for versions one and two, and then he translates in the third version, in the third revision, he translates it as Eruano. If you've got an ear, you may hear a root in that last word that sounds Eru. Familiar. Eru, that's
yeah.
right. So the original version he's working with, Tolkien provides for grace in this line derives from the root lissi, originally meaning sweetness, which he amended to mean grace or blessing.
Okay.
He then revises that and he translates Eruanu to mean the gift of Eru.
Okay. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. What I really like about this is, and Vinyar Tengwar really does a good job of calling this out, is that the gift, I think, is a really interesting, especially when you're talking about men and religion yeah. and gift, that and is a gift. Hella loaded fucking word, right?
Yeah, it is, and everyone knows how I feel about the gift. Blah, da, yeah. blah, blah.
Blah, da, blah, blah.
that's a punk-ass gift, if you ask me.
Well...
And I'm
okay.
referring to whether or not to choose to be mortal or to be immortal, yeah. right? Like our
but
buddy Elrond.
Mm-hmm. But the whole concept of grace and the gift of men, like the language of that and the concepts are all tied together in Lord of the Rings and in the Silmarillion. They're all tied together. So I think you can make a pretty compelling argument that this is intentional, that he's not just... coincidentally using these together.
Oh, absolutely.
For those, I suppose we should explain ourselves. The gift of men is death.
Uh-huh.
More or less. It's the gift of men, according to the elves.
Right.
Is the gift is mortality, basically. It's that men pass out of the world when they die and return to Ilúvatar. It's the and their souls return to him.
All dogs go to heaven.
Yeah. Men's fear of death is a consequence of the marring of Morgoth as opposed to death itself. This whole thing is, you may remember from our episode in the Atherbeth. Vinyar Tengwar makes a really interesting point of calling out the parallel between the elven conception of man's mortality and the Catholic conception of grace, God's gift of undeserved forgiveness. I can't speak to that because I'm not Catholic enough to parse that comparison.
And I can't speak to that because I don't know. I have no grace myself, so I have none to give.
But I remember when I wrote the paper that I thought it was a really interesting parallel, and I agreed with their analysis. So if that's something that interests you, I recommend you check it out. But cool. This is, again, I'm going to keep banging my hammer on this nail till it's flat against the board.
Do it. Yes.
You see, again, he starts out with a word that seemingly works perfectly well. He has this, he creates a root. He gives it a good meaning. It works perfectly well for what he wants to do. And then he turns and he changes the translation that he's using to find something that's more elven and more spiritually elven.
Ooh.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, he is not just making it like picking a different Quenya word. He's changing the translation so that it is less Catholic and more elven. So that the translated prayer would conceivably be something an elf would say and not a Catholic would say. He's translating the meaning of the poem into an elven prayer.
He's immersing you deeper.
Yeah. Which I really love. I really, really love this idea that he's doing this. That blows my mind that he... And I like that he didn't start doing that. I like that he started out doing it really, really Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then he was like, I can't do it. I don't like it. It doesn't work. You're not supposed to have Catholic stuff in Quenya.
Nope.
And you see this... You see this even more so there's something called the Kenya Lexicon. It was published, I mean, he wrote it in the very early stages of when he was developing Quenya. It's called, I call it Kenya. I know it's technically still pronounced Quenya. It's Q-E-N-Y-A.
Okay.
But it's still pronounced Quenya. But for like in my head, I hear it as Kenya. I sort of don't pronounce the U. To differentiate it from Quenya, but it is basically primitive Quenya.
Oh, proto Quenya. Gotcha.
It's proto Quenya. Yeah. It was published in another Elven linguistic journal called Parma Eldalamberon, issue number 12.
Wow.
And it is a list of primitive Quenya roots and the words associated. And what's buck wild about the Quenya lexicon is there are a number of overtly, and I'm not talking about just casually Catholic words, but like bonkers Catholic words, including the mystic names for the Holy Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Sure.
Saint, monastery, crucifixion, nun, gospel. And this one's really interesting. So those are the super Catholic
words.
Wait,
they have a word for nun? Like N-U-N, nun?
Yeah.
Wow.
And there's a proto-Quenya root that lists a word for nun.
Wow. And it's not just like holy woman.
It's nun.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But you do see at this early stage, he starts out very like, you know, comfortable with this. But over time, he's drawing back on that. He doesn't like that. That's not what that's four.
Okay.
So we've got one more example we're going to take a look at, and then we'll dig more into the Quenya stuff.
Sure.
Or the proto-Quenya stuff.
That's so cool.
The last one is also from the Ave Maria.
Okay.
Ave Maria.
Can I ask you a quick question, and you can cut this if you want to.
Yeah, totally.
So the Ave Maria still has the name Maria in it, right? So that's that name traveled over?
Names are names.
Well, I know, but like Mary, Mother of God. I mean, Eru doesn't have a mother named Mary, I'd imagine. So where the hell does Maria come into it?
I would imagine he elected to not try and do a translation of the name, but he probably would. I mean, he may have eventually decided to do that if he'd kept banging at this prayer. But
interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's an excellent point given the weight in that name.
Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of a big deal for Catholics. That's the one thing I do know. We're all about Mary.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Are you saying there's something about Mary?
Ew. I'm saying that we all probably own, if you're of a certain age, you all own that shirt from Hot Topic that says Mary is my homegirl.
Okay.
All have it. Get over it.
All right. So the last one we're going to do is from line 7. We will die. Tolkien has more than a dozen words for death in Quenya over the course of its history, which I think is a little morbid, but that's neither here nor there.
It depends, like, if there's a lot, I mean, right? When we talked about the words for horse, they describe different things about horses, right?
Yeah.
So if they describe different things about death, that's kind of interesting.
To us, and yeah, and that's a really good point, and we'll talk about that. So looking at the words he chooses to use here is really interesting to me. In the earliest version, he uses Urtulm, which he then crosses, out and replaces with Firiemo. Firiemo, that's a hard one. The long M always trips me up. Firiemo, and then in the next revision, he replaces with Efiriemo, and then Firuviame for the remaining ones. Firuviame.
Firuviame. Said it in Italian style. That's wrong.
Anyway, my Quenya pronunciation is never very good. So
I don't know. I think it sounds
really
good. Quenya
bros, come at me. So the earliest version of those words, Urtulm, Urtu, is struck out. No etymology is given. Nobody knows what that is. The best guess is that it might be something related to the Sindarin word girth, meaning death. The next verse evidently abandoned this one for a series of versions, Firiemo, Efiriemo, based on the fear root, which means die and fade.
Ooh, fade. We know a little bit about that from the elf situation.
We do. So I'm not going to dig into like the specific grammatic shenanigans he's getting into across these next three words because it's not real important.
Thank God.
What it is.
I mean, thank Eru.
Yeah. What I will say though is that obviously he has many, many words for death to choose from. Is why I mentioned how many different words there were to choose from.
Okay.
He chose the one specifically that has a gloss there that includes fade.
That's cool.
Which is has that specific connotation to elves.
Yes, queen. I understand. I get it. Oh, you're such a good teacher. Sorry. Got goosebumps because I remembered.
Yeah. That's great. I really think that it can't be coincidental that he chose that because this is such an important concept for elves. And the idea of fading was so abhorrent to them. It was such a uniquely and specifically horrible concept to them.
Oh yeah.
That it really feels like it has to be an intentional choice, and it reinforces this idea that fading means nothing to a Catholic.
Sure.
So
wait,
choosing
why?
The word.
Wait, why?
Well, why would it? What does fading mean to a Catholic? It doesn't mean anything.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Just the word
fade. Fading. Yes. Yeah, fading in the concept of death doesn't mean anything to a Catholic. It doesn't have any special weight. But to an elf, it has enormous spiritual weight.
Yeah.
So choosing the word for death that has this extra meaning of fade simply, to me, reinforces the idea that he's taking these prayers and he is rewriting them to be as if they were written to or for or both an elf.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow, that's so interesting. That's very cool.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting. I'm not going to get into. I went on a little bit of elocution safari when I wrote this paper, trying to find which root theater came from. But I won't get into that here. It's not important. So to get back to the Quenya lexicon, so it has all these primitive roots, but it has another thing that I think is really interesting. So we've seen, I think these examples paint a pretty good case for the way that these prayers are transforming over time from pretty explicit Quenya translations into much more, into basically semantic, he's doing like a semantic translation to transform these prayers into elven prayers for all intents and purposes.
Sure.
And we see this in the Quenya lexicon. We see this early stage of his development. We see all these bonkers Catholic words, but there's a somewhat more subtle example of this as well that I want to talk about.
Okay.
Under Eldamar, which is an older name for Valinor, we see the description is given as the rocky beach in western Inwinor, which is fairy.
Okay.
Whence the Solus Impelli, which is an old name for one of the tribes of elves, have danced along the beaches of the world. Upon this rock was the white town built called Kor, whence the fairies came to teach men song and holiness. This derives from a much earlier version of the legendarium, during which the elves, then fairies, had an explicitly kind of religious or spiritual mission that faded over time, but that's interesting to me that in the early conception, he was much more comfortable having his religion welded into his world building in a much more explicit way than he did later on in life. Mm-hmm. The two became separated the relationship between the two changed over time. I just think it's really interesting that in this early version, he's much more willing to have an overt religious message. Yeah. And it's almost like he's giving the elves a mission that is more in line with a more religious mission. And that fades pretty quickly. You don't see that at all as time goes on. And it becomes sort of subsumed. And I think there's a letter, and if I can find it when we put the sources up, I'll include it.
Sure.
Where he seems to suggest that world building and the secondary world becomes kind of his job as a creator of a secondary world. That's the task for him, and the work itself becomes the part of the work itself becomes the religious work, and it doesn't require him to put religion in it itself
because the whole thing is intrinsically.
Yeah.
It wouldn't exist without it, so it doesn't need to be like smash you in the face because it just
It doesn't need to have Jesus in it,
right?
Because exactly. Which I thought was super interesting, and it feels like it has to have been a little bit of a diss on Lewis, just a little bit.
They were buddies, so it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. So, there's a really, if this is an interesting subject for you, our listeners, I highly recommend John Garth's excellent biography of Tolkien and the Great War, which we've talked about several times now, because you hear a lot of this stuff in the sections about his time during the war when he is first developing his legendarium, the early Kor poems, where he's talking about Kotirion and Kor and all that stuff. He's first developing the languages, and this is where he's first building these concepts.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
And what I learned from earlier in this podcast is if you actually read the word Kor, it's K-O-R, which has to be early because he hadn't switched to a C yet.
Indeed.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah. So that's about all I've got on this for tonight. This is a really fun little sort of corner of Tolkien's writings. He wrote a lot of Quenya, but not as much as you'd think. And it's always interesting to see the analysis that people do of his writing is always super interesting. Fun, interesting fact.
Yeah.
The authors of this paper attempted to translate several of these poems themselves before they were published. These were made public and were published. Let's see. The Paternoster was published by Patrick Wynn and Carl Hostatter in Vineyard Tangwar 32. As he puts it, it is interesting, instructive, and a bit sobering to compare Tolkien's translation of the Paternoster with that made by Patrick Wynn and myself and published in VT 32.
Oh, I see.
Before we were aware even of the existence of Tolkien's version, of course, and to consider the near myths and the many misses of our own effort.
But they did it. That's such a labor of love, you know, without a key. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why not? You can't make it unless you take a swing, right? So that's cool.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question about these five poems? And
Totes.
Maybe you said this and I totally missed it. Did Tolkien ever publish these? Were published?
No, these were found by his son, stuffed in his paper somewhere.
Oh, okay, in the stratigraphy of the desk, right.
Yeah.
So these were just, like, passion projects for him then, we think?
I mean, in the sense that they were literally just stuff he was, like, noodling with. Like, he grabbed whatever paper was nearby and decided I'm going to write down a couple prayers into Quenya.
Wow.
And then went back and edited them and then wrote a couple of more.
Sure.
And then at the end, once he'd done the first... So my take on it, mm-hmm, is he did the first two. He wrote the first two out. The Paternoster and the Ave Maria. And then he revised those a lot.
Okay.
And then once he was pretty happy with those, I think he went and wrote the last three. So I think that's kind of how those ended up happening.
That's really cool. Yeah,
since
it makes
sense. There's
only
a single version of each of the last three. But I thought that was pretty funny. I thought that was pretty cool that they're just on whatever's around. They're random sheets of paper or postcards, stuff like that.
Yeah, when we visited the Tolkien exhibit at the Morgan Library earlier this year, in early 2019, we saw some of these things, not with those specific writings on them, but we saw, I think, the test booklet on which he'd started, mm-hmm, you know, on a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. What a cool thing. Yeah, so you definitely need to check out... the Vineyard Tangwar piece that has the photos in it of his scrawly handwriting. I think John Garth makes the point that Tolkien's mother was descended from engravers. So, and she sort of had this really kind of cool stylistic handwriting too, and Tolkien got it as well. And it's just so cool to actually look at a physical thing that he wrote down. It's very kind of magical and cool.
Yeah. And it should be noted, luckily enough, Vineyard Tangwar is an academic journal, mm-hmm, so it is not available for free.
Oh.
But Vineyard Tangwar 43 is their sample issue. It is available for free on their website.
Cool.
So I will put a link to Vineyard Tangwar 43 in the show notes, so you can download it and check it out for yourself.
Yeah, and their website.
But we will
website.
Also be... Yeah, there, we'll put the link to their website in there as well.
www.elvish.org. So cool.
Yep. And we'll also put the pictures of those postcards on our Instagram as well, because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it really is. He's like writing in the center, and then all of a sudden he sort of like goes up the side, like over his own writing. It's great. And also, man, his handwriting is beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this on our Discord in the past, but mine looks really terrible and bad, and his is like, oh, gorgeous. Looks like I typed it in Microsoft Word and made it a weird font. It's pretty cool. Yeah, this is great.
You compare
great,
those,
absolutely.
Though, to... you compare those versions to the other ones, some of the earlier versions, where his handwriting's a little less precise. So.
Yeah, okay, that's true. Cool.
But,
this was really fascinating. I think as we sort of head into more heavy talks of language, this gives kind of a little... entry point just to get your feet wet a little bit I really enjoyed it. Thank you for all your work. Jude of the present, but also Jude of the past, who wrote that killer paper. What grade did you get? You gonna tell us?
I got a 90 out of 100 on that paper.
Damn, that's good. That was my air horn sound. Yeah, I was
pretty,
that was great.
Pretty proud of it. Yeah.
Look at you. Go and brush your shoulders off.
Yeah.
Good grades.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I feel like I learned a lot.
Yeah, I am. I had a lot of fun with this one. This is obviously kind of like an intersection of some of my bullshit. I really love Quenya. And I got to get on my elven spirituality horse a little bit. So this was a fun one for me.
That's your favorite horse, right? That is your favorite horse.
It really is. So
that's your main horse. That's cool. Well, yep. Awesome. Thank you so much.
That was my pleasure. On and on, but this episode is over.
If you enjoyed this podcast, pretty please leave us a review on iTunes, as it helps increase our visibility. You can find us on the web at www.podcast.atherbeth.com. You can find the show on Twitter at @atherbeth_cast. Jude can be found at @eremiticjude, and I can be found at @the_north_4. Title music is Lord of the Devil Rings by Pony Music, courtesy of Pond 5. Thanks for listening.